Good morning, everybody, and happy New Year. It's already January of 2020. My husband keeps asking, "Can you believe that we are alive in the 20th year of this new century?" My God, it's gone so quickly. We have started with a brand new law. And we'll be talking about that because Jennifer asked a question, a very broad, wide open question, but we'll talk about that. The IRS has announced that they're going to be opening e-filing on January 27th. They got all their work done in time to open tax season, and then Congress came along and on December 18th finished passing this new law. It's a fairly large law. And the big issue about this new law is that it included extenders that went back to 2018 and 2019 retroactively. So not only the IRS, but all of the tax software companies have to retool on quite a number of issues. So I'm not sure if all of the forms and everything are ready, in addition to which, I don't know that Congress really understands the effect they have when they pass something this late in the year, but all the states also have to retool their tax forms and software to either conform or not conform to the new laws. So whenever they do something this late in the year, when everyone else in the country has been responsible and done their jobs, everyone has to redo everything. So we'll see how that affects us. In the meantime, since I've been teaching for CPE Link, and I have to get all the update classes ready. One of the things I've noticed is, for instance, IRS has gotten some things changed. For instance, Schedule 1 does include the tuition and fees, but Schedule A doesn't include any of the changes related to the new law. So this is going to be an awful, awful lot of fun this tax season. Does it remind you of 2018 when Congress passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in December of 2017? Okay. And the other good news is I have my book cover is up on Amazon, and as it happens, the color that I convinced them to use actually matches my lilacs. So I posted a picture of my lilacs in Facebook because they really do look so similar. I posted this cover on Facebook yesterday, and some people were agreeing that they like this cover. I think it's kind of sexy. The contents of the book, well, I am one of those pieces of fallout from Congress's December tax law. And I am frantically trying to update all of the changes after I've already gone to all the trouble to write the book. We are now updating all of the changes. So I have a special chapter at the beginning of the book, of this book, that outlines some of the main tax changes from things like the PATH Act, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and the SECURE Act. And then I'm filtering those things from the SECURE Act into the book. The other acts are already in there. So this has been this year, believe it or not, we're only 9 days into it, and it has been a very frantic year for me. But let's do what we normally do for our tax roundtable. What we do is we start out with introductions. So hopefully everybody has a headset. I will click on your name one person at a time and unmute you. And you know the routine. You tell us your name, where you're located, and why you're here. And if you have any questions that you have not already sent me, I will know to come back and call on you. If you don't have a headset, please feel free to type your introduction and I will be your voice. So let me start off. My name is Eva Rosenberg. I am the Tax Mama. I'm here in sunny Southern California, and I'm here to listen to anything you have to say and to cover anything you want to talk about. And let me unmute you. Good morning, Anne. Do you have a microphone on? We'll come back to you. Sherry, hi. Is it just me? Do I not have my volume up? Yeah, I've got my volume up. Okay. Norbert, we already know. Patrick, hi. I'm hoping, Patrick, that yours will work because we want to talk. Okay, and Tony, nobody's microphone is working today. Okay. Patrick, let me try you again. Patrick? Okay. Well, Norbert is in Starbucks. Sherry says, I can hear. Not sure why you can't hear me, but I'm near Cincinnati. Let me know if you're going to have any questions. Anne says, I did have my mic on. I am Anne McIntyre, San Antonio, Texas, former IRS examiner, EAN CPA, and no questions. Tony, you won't really, you click on the top of the screen. You see where the speaker is vibrating. Next to it, there is a microphone. I will click on that. Tony, let's see if you can get yours to work. In the meantime, Sherry has no specific questions, but thought others would have good insight into the last minute Secure Act changes. Okay. All right, folks, it's just going to be me. So I will read whatever you type into the chat field. Okay, let's start with Patrick because he sent me this, and I'll read the overall questions first and then we'll take it one piece at a time. He said he has a client who has a Form 2553 late S Corp election and using Revenue Procedure 2013-30. The client faxed it into the IRS on February 10, 2019 for tax year 2018, did not get a response. So that's about a year after it's due, if it was due, if it was meant to cover 2018. The next problem was there was no extension filed for the S Corp, and he says that's a huge mistake. But the S Corp tax return for 2018 was filed on August 14, 2019, with a Form 2553. Then the client received a letter denying the S Corp election unless he has proof of a timely submission of a Form 2553 and can present it. Excuse me one second. Okay, and the question is, since the 2553 would most likely have been accepted under Rev Proc 2013-30 in February, is there any chance, hang on, is there any chance that the IRS will grant relief once informed that the form was faxed before the deadline for the tax return? Hang on, got a cold. Sorry. And that the reason the client faxed it instead of mailing the 2553 is that he works abroad. And at this point, a $1,000 penalty for late filing would be the least of the problems. Okay. So we're going to take his questions one piece at a time, but first we'll read Tony's introduction. My name is Tony. I'm two-thirds done with the EA exam, going to finish part three this spring. I am now based in Mexico City again and has no specific questions. Patrick is also in Mexico. So you guys might want to communicate with each other. And Norbert is working on his EA with me, and he has a weird question in the expat forum. So we'll come back to Norbert's question. Okay, so Patrick and Tony have gotten together. Norbert is in Switzerland, also two-thirds done, and an expired CPA. So today's group is particularly international. All right, let's get to Patrick's questions. Okay, yes. Helps if I turn on the mic. So first of all, yeah, this is always a tough situation. He started out with the first part of the question. The late S Corp election was faxed on February 10th of 2019. So that's a year later than it should have been. So my question to you, Patrick, is there any proof that this was faxed to the IRS? My fax machine will spit out a strip or a page that has a confirmation of the date and time it was faxed. Probably your client doesn't have that anymore. Okay, so you did prepare the 2553, and you have the date that you prepared it and sent him the instructions. Good, okay. So if you have that, then there is no reason in the world why your client would not have followed through on your instructions, right? I mean, it's perfectly logical that within a day or two, the client would have done that. So the first thing that I would do, and you have an email to that effect, the first thing that I would do is I would include that in a letter saying that you gave him the information on this date. The client confirmed that that he faxed it, and you have absolutely no reason to believe that he did not, and that you know that the IRS does have a reputation for sometimes losing this information, and you would like the IRS to give him credit for having done this based on your word, your integrity, and so forth. So that's the first thing. Now, you said that there was no extension filed. I don't know how big your client base is, but in all of my years, one of the things that I've always done is I have always filed extensions for my clients. I know I've seen discussions and arguments online, about whether we should be doing it without our client's approval, permission, and so forth, whether it's ethical or unethical for us to do it. But here is my policy. And this is how we've gotten around any of the problems and issues with respect to extensions. Clients that have no taxes due or pass through entities like this, we always file the extensions for them before the due date, hopefully a few days before. That way, when we get work done, even if we're finished by the 15th or the due date, if we need to file electronically, we don't have to be here in case it's rejected. And we still have the extension period to make any corrections. Clients with balances due on their tax return when we are doing it, the projection in April, we send them the extensions and tell them to take care of it themselves. Now, what about clients you haven't heard from yet that haven't come back? My experience with those people is most of those people have not gone anywhere else. They are just flaking out. And so in my experience, I have found they'll come back to me a couple of years later and want me to do those tax returns. They haven't gone anywhere else. I may be wrong, maybe I'm unique, but If we take care of that, even if they've already filed, there is no harm. So that's what I like to do. So that's just the thing about the extension. Now, if in fact the IRS treats that as a late, yeah, see, it's good, Patrick. Right or wrong, you filed the extensions for everyone who hasn't filed on April 13th, should have included this. Okay. For late filing on the partnership return, you are very likely to get, or the S corp return, you're very likely to get the late filing penalties abated. So I would ask for that. Each one of these things is going to be a separate transaction. So one, to get confirmation about the approval for Form 2553. This is the first return. They haven't done anything wrong, and we'll go through some of the reasons. But the late filing penalty, you can probably also abate. It's a first-time event for this entity. So the letter denying the S Corp election, you've already said that you have evidence that he took care of that. And so you used RevProc 2013-30, and it's only for late elections that would otherwise be valid, which this sounds perfectly fine. And here is the general relief for S Corp elections. So the entity intended to be an S Corp and it was eligible. They had reasonable cause for its failure to make the election timely because they didn't have a clue. So they thought their incorporator took care of it is usually the best reason. The entity and all shareholders reported their income consistent with the S Corp election. So you're going to answer these questions in your response to that letter denying the S Corp status. You're going to say they filed their 1040. There's only the one owner. So the shareholders, you know, there is only the one. The one shareholder signed it and approved the election. You can swear that the 1040 was filed, including the income on Schedule E, as though they had actually had an S Corp election. And less than 3 years and 75 days have passed since the effective date of the election. Absolutely, definitely. So, I don't think there is anything here that would not give your client the late election relief. One of the things I find with the IRS about these kinds of issues is it sometimes takes two or three letters going back and forth to respond. But the key here is to respond. You don't want to have to request a private letter ruling. Those can get expensive, but there's a link over here that you can use to follow through any more of the other details and so forth. If you happen to need RevProc 2009-41, I found a really nice flow chart that somebody gave us at our breakfast meeting last month. And here's a link to a flow chart that's big enough for you to follow. But I'm going to say one more thing about this. At our breakfast meeting last month, somebody was telling us about the S Corp election filed for 3 years, or filing for all 3 years. He did get the same IRS notice showing that there was no record of having made the election. He filed all of the tax returns before the 3 years and 75 days, and the IRS did accept it. So the IRS does have a history of accepting these late filed elections. There was another thing. Lulu, what were we talking about? Were about the late S Corp elections, and I didn't know that you could actually get that approved under what circumstance? Yeah, I've got the chart, but what was the issue as an S Corp? And it was late, and they filed late. Yeah, so Lulu was saying something about it was she had a client with an LLC. They were filing 3 years late. This is actually probably her story. They filed 3 years late. Several people mentioned that the IRS is approving seriously late filed elections as long as it's within that 3 years and 75 days. So all you have to do is be persistent and keep responding and don't take no for an answer. Your client will get that accepted. Your big issue is the late filing penalties, but there's only one shareholder. So, the penalties will go for up to 12 months of late filing for the one shareholder. And in this case, the tax return was due in March. So you're filing in August. That's about 5 months. Not the end of the world, but I think you can get that abated as well. So do you have any questions about this? I think you're going to be fine. But use the list on the previous page to and answer those questions in your letter, and you should be just fine. Okay, great. All right. So yeah, hopefully he won't have to pay the $1,000, and he can pay you a few hundred dollars instead because your fee is deductible, the $1,000 is not. You're worth so much more than that. Okay. Then Jennifer asked if I could go over some points of the further Consolidated Appropriations Act that was signed on December 20th by the president. Well, it's a big question, Jennifer. There were 715 pages in that act, so not sure what you want me to go over, but I will give you some information. I did actually look up this morning exactly how many pages were specifically related to the income tax changes or a lot of other changes. And so this is the link to the information on the law itself and where you can find the PDF file of the law. But the revenue provisions are in Division Q, and there are about 45 pages worth of those, and that includes the extenders. And then in Division O, there are not that many. This is the retirement part of it, so it only goes from 693 to 714. So really, there are only about 60 pages or so out of the 750 that are specifically related to our potential tax clients. And those 60 pages are making me totally crazy because I have two federal tax update classes to teach at CCH next week. And I have two classes over the next 2 weeks relating to the federal tax updates and how it relates to California. So here are the classes. And so, Norbert, this is where I am offering them. So they are at CCH CPE link. If you click on Team Tax Mama, you will find the information and they will be recorded. So if the time zone doesn't work for you, because they're going to be, I think, at 9 a.m. Pacific for the Tuesday and Wednesday part one and part two federal tax updates. I'm not sure what time they are for the California updates the following 2 weeks. So in the meantime, we also had, I don't know if you're familiar with Twitter and tax Twitter chats, but the folks at clientwise.com have a bunch of different websites, and one of them is the Tax Buzz website, and they do a monthly Tax Buzz chat on the first Wednesday of each month, or maybe the second, because the first one was probably New Year's Day. And so they did that yesterday, and there were a dozen questions that Lauren had put together to ask. And these were the primary people that typically participate in those chats and answer some of those questions. So she's actually got it posted. She summarized yesterday's chat with the 12 questions and our comments and answers about basically our opinions and thoughts about 12 issues relating to the last minute extenders and the Secure Act changes. So if you're interested in seeing a compilation of everybody's ideas and opinions, please click on this link and you can see the conversation in there. Now, as for specifics, right before the end of the year, as soon as the Congress passed this Extenders Act and the Secure Act and so forth, I put together a summary of all of the different provisions that are going to affect us and sent that out as a tax quip. I haven't sent anything out yet this year, I don't think, but this was the last thing in December. So the Division Q things that turn out to affect us retroactively, it affects 2018 and 2019, and some of these things will also go through 2020. So for a change, they are covering the current year that we're living in. For your clients who had mortgage premium insurance, mortgage insurance premiums, or whatever, PMI, it is now deductible. So if they had large amounts, especially if they just bought the house, that may be something you might want to go back and amend. It's a consideration. Medical expenses, which were about to get reduced by 10% this year, are now back down to a threshold of 7.5%. The principal residence debt cancellation that expired at the end of 2017, that's back. So the debt cancellation is not taxable as long as it qualifies for acquisition debt. The tuition and fees expense of $4,000 that expired at the end of 2017, that's back and that's already on Schedule 1 that I mentioned at the beginning. So that's already in the forms. IRS reserved the line. The personal residence lifetime $500 tax credit for people who put new insulation, double-paned windows, and all of that other stuff into their home, they only get this tax credit once for $500, once in a lifetime, not once on a home or anything. And it keeps expiring. It's not worth a heck of a lot. I mean, if you consider how much it costs to put in new windows, about $7,000 as $500 credit is like, wow. And if they've ever taken it before, we get in trouble for taking it again. We have the various electric and fuel cell vehicle credits back in shape, so we have that. And the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act created an employer tax credit for paid family leave. Employers were just starting to figure out how to use it when it expired at the end of December 2019, and we get it back for one more year. Now, all of these things can affect 2018. If it's going to make a significant difference for your clients, what you might want to do is while you're talking to them about their tax return this year, sit down and look at last year with them, see if it makes a big enough difference, and ask them if they want to amend. If it's worthwhile, fine, but I'm going to tell you right now, if you file an amended return, and many people will, especially all of those people who do their own tax returns on TurboTax and H&R Block, they're going to be going crazy with amended returns. The IRS is going to be backlogged. They're already backlogged for a number of other reasons. So instead of the usual 12 weeks it takes for an amended return to be processed, it could take 6 months. Anytime you do an amended return, make sure you include everything that the examiner needs to see. I don't care what the IRS tells you they want to see. I absolutely recommend that you include a copy of the pages from the original tax return as they were. We have a stamp that we have bought that we stamp every one of those pages as originally filed in red ink. And then prepare the amended return, the 1040X, and the relevant pages, all the relevant pages of the new amended tax return. And we have a stamp in red that we stamp every page as amended. So in case the pages come apart, they will show the name and social security number of the client, and they will show whether they're the corrected ones or the original pages. So I don't care what else the IRS, says they want to see. If you include all of those and any proofs of the deductions you're taking, make sure you include any proof of the deduction or the costs. Your client's tax return will be processed sooner than anyone else's because they won't need to ask for any additional information. So think about when you're working on a client's return, if you have everything you need, you can knock it out, and they're no different. So these are the extenders, and there are others. There are others that relate to businesses and various other credits and things like that, and Indian tribes and so forth. And I gave you the link so that you can look up the specifics. Then we have the changes. And so this is the part that's called the Secure Act. And here are some of the changes that I've posted. There is a new $500 employer tax credit for setting up a retirement plan or adding this provision to a retirement plan. This is an automatic enrollment provision. So if your clients don't already have a retirement plan, they can still get the $500 credit on Form 8881 for setting up a brand new plan for the first 3 years of the plan for $1,000 worth of maintenance expenses, administrative expenses. And so up to $1,000 a year, they can get half of that as a credit for $500. They can get this additional credit also for 3 years if they add or put in an automatic enrollment provision so that employees are automatically enrolled in the plan, whether they don't have to opt in, they have to opt out. So that's a new provision. That's an extra $500 tax credit. Then they have a provision that part-time employees may qualify for 401k participation. Typically, these are employees who have been with the company for 3 years, are age 21 or over. There's also provision for people who are there for a whole year. So there are a number of different provisions that make it possible for part-time employees to be included in 401k participation. I have to admit, I thought you could always do that if you wanted to. So, this is fine. This specifies it. Then we have certain fellowships and stipend payments. We have some issues for people who have otherwise non-taxable income. And so this is healthcare workers and people who have non-taxable scholarships and things like that. The plan, this Secure Act, allows them to treat that income as qualified earned income so that they can make IRA contributions. So more people are being enabled to make retirement contributions to IRAs and 401k plans than before. The other thing that we have now, bear in mind, for instance, these two, check with your state. The state may not have complied to that. Same thing with the next one. The IRA contribution limit presently has been age 70 and a half. They have removed that age limit. So as long as an individual has earned income, they're going to be able to make contributions, deductible contributions to their IRAs. But be careful Because if your state hasn't complied with that, then they may not have a deductible contribution on their tax return, and you will want to track the basis for the state. You may find yourself with a separate basis for the state. The other thing that they did was, right now, until now, we've had an age 70 and a half requirement to take required minimum distributions from IRAs and retirement plans. And if the taxpayer did not take it, the fee, the penalty was like 50% of the amount they should have taken. Now they have changed the required age to 72. So I'm not really clear if it's going to follow the same rules as 70 and a half, the 70 and a half rule, which was you have to start taking it the year after you turn 70 and a half. And does that mean that we're going to have to start taking it the year after we turn age 72, and then in that year take the prior year's distribution and the current year's distribution? I'm not absolutely clear on this one, but I think it's going to follow the same rules. Then they have an interesting provision that you can take money from IRAs or retirement plans for adoptions and avoid the 10% early withdrawal penalty. The limit is up to $5,000 per child that is born or adopted, and you don't have to actually use the money for the adoption. It just has to be withdrawn in the year of the adoption. So you'll have to be able to have your client prove that they had the adoption take place that year. Sherry, do you expect the IRS to update the RMD tables or use the existing ones? Yes and yes. Remember, people who are already taking required minimum distributions are still going to be following the old rules. So there are people who need to be continuing on the path they've already started, and the new people, and this will affect people who turn age 72 starting in 2020. So many of these things are going to take effect in 2020 or after 12/31/2019. The extenders started in 2018 through 2020. So many of these changes don't take effect until 2020. Good question. We'll be able to take money from our Section 529 plans to help pay for the student loans. So we'll be able to use up to $10,000 from the 529 plan without penalties and use that to cover both principal and interest. Obviously, if we use it to cover interest, we won't be able to deduct that interest as a deductible student loan interest expense. Then we've got the inherited IRAs and qualified plans for non-spouses. Spouses still have the same rules. They can still treat it as their own plan and do a lot of different things. But people who are non-spouse beneficiaries, they had a set of rules, and they were allowed to either take the money over 5 years or spread it over their lifetime. Now that's been expanded to 10 years. And there are a lot of exceptions to this particular batch of people who may not have to follow these rules. And then I saw something, somebody had an entire class about how to use this for trust planning. There are questions about how this affects trusts. And so I'm not really clear. This one is going to have some very definite complications because you might still have the underlying 5-year rules. You might still have other rules that come into play. But one thing that's not going to happen is on new deaths, on new inheritances, the beneficiaries will not be able to take it over their actuarial life anymore. So I think the maximum is going to be the 10 years. And then they got back to the kiddie tax. I think the members of Congress came to realize that their children were facing the kiddie tax rules, and that on their 2018 tax returns, the children may have had to pay 37% taxes on their unearned income in excess of $12,500. And I think that woke them up. And so now they restored the original rules where the children will pay tax on their unearned income at the highest rate of their parents' tax return. And we have the option, not the requirement, to go back to 2018 and amend, or to do that in 2019, or amend that if that gets done before people realize it. Starting in 2020, it will be effective. So if you do happen to have children who have a lot of investment income because their grandparents or whatever set things up, or they have scholarships or things that were taxable and subject to the trust tax rates of 37%, you may want to take a look at that. So that's another thing that actually goes retroactively to 2018. So those are the high points. There's a lot more in that. As I said, there are about 65 pages just related to our tax issues. So does anybody have anything specific or any other questions about the Secure Act? As I said, this is something that I am really seriously exploring what needs to get put in and interlaced into the Small Business Taxes Made Easy book, which only will cover the business aspects of these changes. So Sherry is typing a question. Does anyone have any other questions or observations or ideas or anything else? Meanwhile, Norbert had to leave us because he had other things going on. Something about Credit Suisse. Sherry, I thought I heard from someone at Compass say the IRA WD exemption was for the birth of a child. The adoption, well, the adoption provision included birth or adoption. I'm not certain if it's the birth of your own child or the birth of a child you're adopting. So that's something that I need to clarify. I heard them say that too, but they were talking about adoption at the time. So you're going to have to, if you want to, read the law carefully, but I may hang on to your note and see if it's something that I might be able to answer when I do the class for CPE Link next week. Yes, sorry, it's not in the year of the birth. It's within 12 months of the adoption or the birth. Yes, that's a good point, Sherry. The Compass class was really terrific. They had that class on the 29th of December on Friday, and they only charged $39 for it. It was a really good value. So if you did not take it, it's probably well worth it because you'll have access to that information. And if they toss in any updates in there, that is definitely worth doing. That's at Compass Tax Educators. It was Tom Gorshinsky and Kevin Houston that were teaching and moderating it. CPE co comes from Cheryl Trovato's USTC class, U.S. Tax Court class. If anyone wants to sit for the U.S. Tax Court exam, it's going to be offered in November of this year, and that is the only class to take if that's what you want to do. She has the people who pass the USTC exam, the tax court exam, in the last 10 years or so, most of the people who pass are people from Cheryl's class. So she does a really good job, and now she's gotten smart and she has two or three of her graduates teaching with her. So the burden is spread out a little bit. She's got some good people teaching with her. So, anyone else have any other questions? I know Wibbick is typing, but I haven't seen the results of anything that was typed. Anyone else have anything else you want to bring up or talk about? We still have about 10 minutes. So, if anyone has anything else that you want to, oh, hang on. Norbert had posted something and we didn't get back to it. He said a lady who won the lottery in Australia claimed that she would not need to report the earnings as her husband is a non-resident alien and they will be claiming her husband received the winnings. Sounds risky to me, but I watched the other EA's answer and they all seem to agree. Norbert wants to know my opinion. Oh, that's an interesting question. Here's the deal. In Australia, if you have a spouse who is a non-resident alien, and you are not filing a joint return with that spouse, you have not picked him up as and treated him as your spouse on your tax returns, so you're not filing a joint return. He bought the ticket and he owns it. They could get away with not reporting that, but he puts it into a bank account and they both own the bank account. Then she's going to need to pick up any of the earnings on that account and she's going to need to file the FBAR and the FATCA forms on that account in the future. Or in the year in which that happens. Wivik says, I have questions from a client that converted a traditional IRA to a Roth and in the same year took money out from the Roth to pay college expenses because her financial advisor said it's tax-free, no penalty, under age 59 and a half and less than 5 years. Well, she should have taken the money out first. First of all, it's not tax-free, it's just no penalty. When she converted the IRA to the Roth, she would have to pay all of the taxes on that conversion. And again, no penalty on the conversion. So once she's paid taxes on the conversion, then she can take the money out of the Roth tax-free. However, remember, when it comes to a Roth, the account has to be open for 5 years in order to take the money out without any penalties. So Wibbick says, I would say only the earning of that Roth would be a pe no penalty, in my opinion. Well, there's not going to be any penalty generally, but if they take it out in less than 5 years, there may be a withdrawal penalty on the IRA. But there's a basis, right? Because you just paid tax on it, so the penalty would only be on the earnings. Patrick, what is the approximate response time for becoming an acceptance agent? My application is already with the IRS. Wow, you should have done that years ago. Typically, they say about 3 months. So I know you probably took care of that about 2 months ago. So you should be hearing from them shortly. But it's the beginning of the year, so check with them. Right now, if you did it about 2 months ago, just check with them and ask if they need anything. If there's anything else that they need, you're just touching base. You're not really expecting them to already process it, but just a friendly hello. The worst that'll happen is they'll say it's actually ready and we're going to be approving it. So actually that might happen. Good. Anyone else have anything else that you want to bring up? Yeah, I used to say when it came to the EA application and things like that, to leave IRS alone for the 60 days that it says on the instructions that it takes for the application to get processed. And, I base that recommendation on the fact that we hate it when our clients call us, is it ready yet? Is it ready yet? We want to put those guys at the bottom of the list, but there is a problem with the system. And when you file it online and you pay online, IRS sends an email, or the system sends an email, pay.gov sends an email saying that they received your application when in fact they've only received the money. Pay.gov received the money. IRS itself refuses to set up an autoresponder saying, yes, we actually got your application. And they lost a lot of applications in the last 2 years. Sherry looked at the actual bill. In general, the term qualified birth or adoption means any distribution from an applicable eligible retirement plan to an individual if made during the 1 year period beginning on the date when a child of the individual is born or on which the legal adoption of an eligible individual is finalized. Qualified birth. Gotta, thank you, Cheryl. Gotta find what qualified birth is. So, gotta find the definition of that. So that's going to be the defining factor. Will that apply to all births or adoption-related births? So I'm not really clear on that part of it. Appreciate your looking that up. Cool. Anyone else have anything? Whoops. Yeah, and I'm pretty sure, whoops, pretty sure that I gave you guys the link to the law. So the link to the law is over here. This will let you download it as PDF, as text, or any other number of different ways. Okay, I will be posting, you can already find the handout in the board. I will be posting the summary of this information or the handouts and the recording at the Tax Mama website when we're done. And I think nobody else has anything. So have a really terrific tax season. I may see some of you at next week's CCH tax classes. By the way, nobody here is in California, so you don't care about the California issue, so I won't bring that up. And other than that, we have a follow-up session for those of you studying for the EA exam. We have a follow-up session next Tuesday. So if you have EA-related questions, if you have EA-related questions, please make sure you get them to me Monday, no later than Monday morning. Celine, you're in California. One piece of bad news, we had about six major fires and disasters in California in 2019. Not a single one of them has been approved and declared as a presidentially declared disaster area. So we can't take any deductions for any casualty losses whatsoever on the federal tax return. We can do it only in California. So we are apparently at war with the President of the United States, who refuses to certify any of our disasters. They are all declared by the governor of the state, but not the president. And under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, we can't take any casualty losses unless it's a presidentially declared disaster area. So I know we have many representatives and two senators in Congress from California, but one of our most visible members of the House of Representatives is Nancy Pelosi. You know what? She and the president aren't getting along. So we aren't getting the routine benefits of being citizens of the United States. Anyone else have anything else that you need to bring up? Just imagine if California seceded from the Union, or if the people in California decided that they're going to put all of their federal tax dollars into a trust fund until the President of the United States returns our benefits to us. That could be pretty devastating to the U.S. Treasury. We apparently pay the most taxes, federal taxes of any state in the Union. And one article I found says that Californians pay more tax than 25 of the smallest states combined. So 25 out of 50 states, we pay more taxes than half of the country combined. So I think that we have a lot of power. If people get sufficiently upset about the way we're being treated by the government we're paying to support, who knows? Anyway, don't want to get political, but we all like numbers and statistics. Okay. And Patrick says we're one sixth of the US economy instead of 2%. Not too bad. Okay, guys, we're good for today. Have a great January. And you know, if you have any questions, you can post them in the board under client questions or on the Tax Mama website, and I will always, always answer. All right.